So I have come today to speak to you about a great, deep, spiritual truth. This deepest of human mysteries, a sacrament even, which is barbecue. Barbecue is one of the greatest gifts that God has given to human beings. It is the Feast of Kings, the grease and the salt, as it fills your mouth, makes your taste buds dance in delight. And we all know that there's only one place to eat barbecue, which is the capital of barbecue, which is Memphis, Tennessee. There are many, many people who try to impersonate or perhaps even to copy this beauty, which is only visible in Memphis, but they fail. It's a desperate, desperate thing that they attempt. They should simply give it over and let people make their annual pilgrimage to eat of the pig. And going to Texas, as I did for so many years, and they said that they had barbecue, but it wasn't barbecue. It was Sunday roast beef. That's what they called barbecue. But we all know that brisket is not barbecue. It's Sunday dinner. Barbecue is its own excellence. And of course, then there are those people in North Carolina who think that they have barbecue, but it's not barbecue either. It's this slurry that's lost in the vinegar and should simply be thrown out. I was going to say thrown to the pigs, but that's probably not quite right. But you see how it is that barbecue is a sacrament in that it unifies the people of Memphis. While it is riven by strife, like so many of the great cities of our nation, this one thing makes Memphis one. It is the barbecue. And of course, like all religions, it is own denominations, of course. So there are people who say that you can only have barbecue at the Rendezvous downtown. And then there are people that say, no, Midtown Corky's Barbecue is the only place to go. And then there, of course, are those people who don't want to go downtown and so are content to eat at the commissary out in Germantown. And that's fine. Of course, as the ladies want to make sure that they get their greens in, that the commissary serves that lovely, delectable bite, which is known as pig in the garden, which is a green salad with a pound of pulled pork barbecue slapped on top. But nonetheless, we all agree that it is a delicious delight, a gift from heaven on high, that there is this thing called barbecue. But you can't eat it if you're Jewish. It's not kosher. You can't eat that. There are all kinds of things that if you were a Jew, you're not allowed to eat because you have this thing called the kosher or dietary laws, which on the face of it makes life without barbecue a very terrible thing, and the other thing that goes well with barbecue that they can't eat either, which is bacon-wrapped shrimp. But I'm not making this stuff up, as a matter of fact. We find in the book of Leviticus, at the beginning of the Bible, the book of Leviticus contains God's words to Moses and him to the Israelites as they were standing before God's glory on the Mount Sinai in the middle of the desert. They had come up out of slavery in Egypt, and now God was giving them His law. And here it is in the book of Leviticus. God says to Moses, "You shall not eat any of these, the camel, because it chews the cud, but does not have a split hoof. That is unclean to you. And you cannot eat the rabbit, because it chews the cud, but does not have a split hoof. That is unclean to you as well. And the pig, The pig does not, you cannot touch the pig because it does have a split hoof and is cloven footed, but it does not chew the cud, and so it is unclean to you. Eat any of these or their flesh, and you shall not touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you. And the rest of the chapter goes on with minute detail about all the various and sundry things that the Jews could not eat, whether they be fish, some fish they could, some not, birds, some could, some not, insects, some could, some not, rodents, gerbils are all unclean. Every last one of them, unclean. But you see how it is that we are often tempted by the modern scholars to say that this is simply a cultural mandate being written into this so-called holy book that simply reflected their desires to be clean. This is a hygiene question, and perhaps a deep ancient suspicion about what we know now as foodborne disease. But if we follow this way of interpreting the text, we would be terribly mistaken. No, all of these food laws had a deeper theological meaning. The food laws were given to set Israel apart as a special people away from all of the surrounding Gentile pagan nations. The Jews were God's chosen people, and they were to stand apart and shine into a dark and dying world as a light, God's own people. It wasn't just their food that was strange. Moses received from God also laws relating to the clothes that they were going to wear, and also special hairstyles. You may have noticed the ultra-Orthodox Jews, even to this day, have those curly cues. They're actually called peyas, but those are the edge, that's the edge of the beard. And a godly Jew was not supposed to trim his beard. So all of these, while we may find them strange these thousands of years later, were not about making sure that the Jews did not come down with trichinosis, but instead they were given by God to the Jews to set them apart from all of the nations of the world so that they might be God's special testimony to the world that had fallen so far from Him. But you see, once you have committed to this idea that Israel is set apart, then the coincident idea comes fully into view as well, which is that the Gentiles themselves, who ate all of these things that were declared unclean, that the Gentiles themselves were unclean. This is the deeper understanding as well, that those who eat these things, they are unclean. They are far from God. They are outside of His community. They were like those yucky animals that the Jews would not even touch. And this attitude, of course, led to each one, the Jew and the Gentile alike, to despise one another, to hate one another, to avoid one another, and not to do what God had called Israel to do after all, which was to bring the nations into His kingdom. Now, we've got the table set. So what does this have to do with our series in the book of Acts? It has everything to do with what Peter saw that day, that vision. Here we have, in our chapter in Acts today, Peter goes on a bit of sabbatical. It's been a rough few years. I mean, he's had the highs of being part of Jesus' close community, then there were the lows of Jesus' crucifixion and death, and then, of course, the elation of Jesus being raised from the dead and His ascension into heaven, and then, of course, going out and receiving the power of the Spirit and all of those moments in which the thousands begin to believe, but then Stephen is executed cruelly and they all go to the four corners of the winds there, being spread abroad by persecution in Jerusalem. Talk about a roller coaster. Peter needed a break. And off he went down to a little town called Joppa, which is just 10 miles outside the modern city of Tel Aviv, down on the coast by the Mediterranean. Lovely. A beach vacation. And off he went to the top of the little house that he was staying in. Most of the houses are built in that part of the world with flat roofs. It's patio. You go up there, enjoy the breezes. And he went up there to pray, and it was lunchtime, the sixth hour of the day, and he was hungry, and he asked them for something to eat. And as he waited with grumbling tummy, he slipped into this vision, and the vision was a gigantic bedsheet being let down from heaven by the four corners. And when Peter looked over the edge of this bedsheet, what did he see? Barbecue. He saw all manner of unclean animals, whether it be gerbils or rats or pigs or snakes, all kinds of things that he was not allowed to eat. Can you imagine a devout Jew like Peter? The head snapped back when he saw what was in the sheet. But then the voice that goes along with the vision says, "Get up, kill something, and eat it." And his response, of course, is, "No, Lord, you know how devout I have been all my life. I have been devoted to you and to your law. I've never eaten anything that is unclean." And the voice comes again. "Don't you dare call something unclean that I have now made clean." And just to make sure that he got it, he saw the vision three more times. Well, a total of three times, two more times. What is going on here? What is Peter supposed to understand? That now he can eat barbecue? Is that the point? That he can now open the first barbecue restaurant in Tel Aviv? This is, if we think so, we would have missed the point. This is not business advice at all. As the vision goes away, there's a banging on the door. And who's standing at the door? An unclean man, a Gentile, who's asking Peter to come with him to meet a Roman centurion, the very image or icon of the power of the foreign Gentile superpower in their land, the very image of uncleanness in the midst of Israel. "Come and meet my master and share with us the gospel." Unclean animals, unclean people. The voice, "Don't say, don't call unclean what I have now made clean." You see, Peter struggled to understand what God was doing in the world. Peter, like all of the apostles, good Jews, every last one of them, assumed that yes, God was in the business of saving the world, but any Gentile who wanted to come into God's family must become Jews first, observe all of the rites of Israel before they could believe in Jesus and have expectation of God's loving promises and care. Peter was confirmed in this. Even though he had this vision at this moment, Peter continued to struggle with the implications of what it meant to be in Jesus' family, even to the moment at which Paul had to set him straight in Antioch. In the book of Galatians, Paul's letter to the Galatians, we hear about an argument between Peter and Paul, which is so strange. We often think that the apostles were of one mind, but they weren't. Not on this critical question, who can be in God's family? And Paul writes to the Galatians this way, "When Peter came up to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he was condemned. For before certain men came up from Jerusalem from James, Peter was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before all of them, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Peter was willing to sit with Gentile Christians and eat with them in fellowship and to receive their community as fellow brothers and sisters in the dead and risen Messiah. But when the conservative party came up from Jerusalem and began to count noses up there in this new congregation in Antioch, Peter said, nope, I'm going to sit over here in the corner and I'm not going to eat with those Gentiles anymore, even though they believe in Jesus. And Paul says, the church doesn't work that way. The church does not work that way because God has made clean what was once unclean. The Gentiles are now rightful members of God's family. And Peter, you are wrong. And you are selling a false gospel. Strong words from one apostle to the next. You see, my friend, God's purpose has always been to save the whole world. Peter couldn't understand that God's family was no longer identified by the marks of circumcision and kosher laws and funny haircuts and going to temple in Jerusalem. Peter couldn't get his head around this new paradigm, but it was Paul, guided by the Holy Spirit, that showed him that the church now was shaped around the Messiah. Faith in Jesus. Now, one mistake that people in our own day make when they approach this passage is to think that all that Luke is trying to teach us here in the 10th chapter is that we should be tolerant of other people. You know, that is the only virtue that we have left in our society is tolerance, right? Just be nice to everybody and don't hold on to any kind of ideology or philosophical or theological teachings. Just be tolerant. Get one of those stickers that spells out in all the sacred images of all of the world's religions, coexist. Slap one of those on the back of your car. Make sure that everybody knows how tolerant you are. Is that what's going on here? Once there were nasty Gentiles and snotty Jews, and now Peter's supposed to learn that everybody's just supposed to get in the middle of the street and just have a great big hug? Is that what's going on here? I don't think so. That's not what's going on here. If that's true, then it would make a complete mess out of the greater question, why did Cornelius bother to call Peter? If Cornelius, the pagan Gentile who has been hanging around the Jewish synagogue, instead of worshiping Zeus or Jupiter or whoever he wants to worship, why doesn't he, if all religions are exactly the same, why doesn't he just congratulate himself and go back to the way things were? But Cornelius knows that things aren't that way anymore. He can't go back to the pagan gods anymore. But as a matter of fact, the God of the Jews is the true God, and he wants to hear about this amazing person named Jesus. The pagan gods, the gods of the Romans, the gods of the Gentiles, they were false gods. They were demons. They led to death. Cornelius is not willing to coexist. Cornelius wants to live, and he wants to live as a member of God's family. You see, here in this passage, we should be confirmed in the truth and the joy, which is that God's invitation calls all people, Jew and Gentile alike, away from death to life. That we, each one of us, whether Jew and Gentile, must be purged of those old gods that would drag us away into self-destruction. That those gods of violence, of money, of sexual perversion, those gods of, if you remember, Mars and Mammon and Venus, all of those ancient, powerful gods, Jesus has destroyed them. And all of us are called into the life that is offered to us in the resurrection of Jesus. You see, the point that Luke is trying to bring us to is that God had finally broken down the barriers that had divided the Jews from the Gentiles. God had called Abraham and the Jews to be a light to the nations. Jesus himself had told the Samaritan woman at the well that salvation comes from the Jews. But now that division could hold no longer. Abraham's call was to save all of the world, not simply the Jews. My friends, in our day today, I cannot imagine a nation more divided than we, divided by age, divided by income, divided by race, divided by gender orientation. How many more ways can we be divided? But our passage today should remind us that God is in the business of recovering the dead and bringing unity out of division, not out of coexistence or simply willing to be tolerant towards other people, but by showing them that life comes from God's Spirit and God's Son alone. But we should not be self-congratulatory. We shouldn't be like Peter, who was content to say, "Sure, just come on in when you're ready to take on all of the burdens that we're ready to saddle you with as good Jews." We should be ready, instead, to be like Paul, who go out into the highways and the byways to find the brokenhearted, to find the disillusioned, to find the marginalized, to find the people that we are not anything like, and to show them how it is that all of our hopes and all of our dreams have been made true in Jesus. Amen.